the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peek.
And I'm Katie Mullally. And this morning, we speak with award-winning journalist for Fortune magazine, Jeremy Kahn, who discusses his new book, Mastering AI, A Survival Guide to Our Superpowered Future.
And then owner and founder of Nexus IT, Earl Foote, a local IT company. Earl walks us through the debacle behind the CrowdStrike technology update that upended healthcare and air travel over the last few weeks and explains sort of how it happened and how we can safeguard against it. That all coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Our next guest, Jeremy Kahn, is an award-winning journalist for Fortune magazine, where he covers artificial intelligence and other emerging technologies. He joins today to discuss the perils and promises of AI, which he details in his book, Mastering AI, A Survival Guide to Our Superpowered Future. Jeremy draws on his expertise and extensive contacts among the companies and scientists at the forefront of artificial intelligence. He offers dramatic predictions of AI's impact over the next decade, from reshaping our economy and the way we work, learn, and create, to unknitting our social fabric, perhaps jeopardizing our democracy, and even fundamentally altering the way we think. Jeremy Kahn, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, this is such a relevant topic, really in everyone's minds. And I think that many of us don't know how to approach AI. On the one hand, we celebrate it. On the other hand, we're very scared of it. I think some people don't want to even wade into the whole AI arena. What are you finding as a journalist who writes primarily on AI?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is some reason to have all those feelings about this technology. Where I end up coming down in the book, and which is largely based on research I've done in the past year, plus the 8 years I spent really covering the subject, is that there is sort of promise and peril here in almost equal measure. I would say, you know, there are some really great transformative effects I think the technology is going to have, particularly in science and particularly in medicine. I think those are some of the areas where it will have the most positive impact on our lives. But I do think there are real dangers here, too, that we should be a little bit worried about, particularly, I think some of the risks it poses around democracy and disinformation, some of the risks around bias, sort of hidden bias that may sneak into some of our decision making. And I also think, there are some risks and concerns around what it will do to the way we relate to one another. And I think those are actually risks that don't get talked about enough. One of the risks that does get talked about a fair bit, which I think is a bit overplayed, is the idea that we're all going to lose our jobs. I don't think that that's actually what's going to happen. I do think some people's jobs will change. And I think there's possible that a few people will lose their jobs potentially as a result of this technology, as people have with other technologies. But the idea that suddenly we're all going to be out of work, and there are people who sort of raise the specter of mass unemployment, I think that's a real red herring.
Well, we found you, Jeremy, because you were recently in Park City here for the Fortune Brainstorm Tech Conference that is held every year, but we hear very little about it. Can you just give a brief overview of what it was, and then we'll ask about some of the takeaways?
Sure, of course. So Fortune Brainstorm Tech is an annual conference. It's sort of our premier tech conference that we as Fortune as a publication hold. The conference has not actually been in the Salt Lake City area for too many years. This was only the second year we had been in Salt Lake City. It's held in Deer Valley, a little outside of Salt Lake City. But this was only the second year we were there. Prior to this, the conference has been going on since the late 1990s, but it had been held in Aspen, Colorado. So always in the mountains somewhere, but we had recently relocated, to the Wasatch Range there. And You know, and it draws people, though, both from the local area. We had quite a number of people who are involved in the tech community in the Salt Lake City area there. But it also draws quite a lot of people from the West Coast, from San Francisco, from Seattle. A good number of people come over from the East Coast, from both New York and Boston and Washington, D.C. for it as well. We had some people from elsewhere in the country. And we do even draw some people from abroad for the conference. There were people there this year from Tokyo. I'm based in the UK, and I came over. There were a few other European-based folks there, although it's primarily, I'd say, an American audience, and most of the speakers are from U.S. venues. It is primarily a business conference, so it's big companies and their chief technology officers or chief data officers, sometimes their CEOs. It is also founders of startups and venture capitalists who back those startups. And then there's some people from government and some people from who come from academia as well.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Jeremy Kahn. He is the author of the new book, Mastering AI, A Survival Guide to Our Superpowered Future. And he was also at the recent tech conference here in Park City up at the St. Regis, I believe. Well, Jeremy, there's so much talk. Okay, we always hear people talking about the pros and cons of AI. And typically the cons come from the non-tech, you know, creatives, writers, anybody that's not familiar with it. And all of the pros come from the tech world. What cons and what fears have you heard from people that are actually in tech that are truly immersed in this industry?
Yeah, okay, so there's several. I think people in the tech industry do think there are some legitimate concerns around the production of sort of misinformation at scale, that this is a real concern that we should be worried about. I think they're a little bit worried about how some of these AI models might make it easier for people to perpetrate cyber attacks. One of the things that these AI models are very good at today and are likely to get better at is coding. And they can often do this in a sort of automated way based on some text prompts. And there's a sense that they could be prompted to create better malware or think of better ways to try to attack networks. You could potentially, if a hacker already had access to a network, you could sort of download the code from that network potentially to one of these AI models and ask it to find vulnerabilities or approaches to attack those models. So I think that's one area where people have some real concerns who are involved in the industry. Certainly there are people involved in the industry who are very aware that because we are training these systems for the most part from human data and vast amounts of human data, that they tend to ingest and kind of replicate, and in some cases even amplify, existing human biases. And I think there, you know, you hear that criticism very much from people outside tech, but there are also people at these companies who are very concerned about this and are trying to take steps to mitigate this. There is, of course, if you work in one of these tech companies, I think there is some conflict or some tension, I should say, because they're under a lot of pressure to try to get these AI models out quickly. There's a lot of competition between these companies. And there's a question, I think, always about how much they are doing really to try to mitigate some of these risks around bias when they're under so much pressure to get the latest system out, and also to just find more and more data. These systems keep getting larger and larger, and they keep needing more and more data to train them. And when you do that, it's harder to be discriminating about what data you're feeding the systems. And I think there's sometimes a sense that these things are real gluttons for data. They kind of hoover up everything. You have to feed them everything you can, and they tend to get better the more data you feed them. And that has sometimes led to a case where we have systems that do really exhibit these historical human biases, and it can be very hard to sort of get that, train that out of the system once it sort of does the initial ingesting and training. The other thing I would say is that it is true that a lot of people who are very close to the cutting edge of this technology are also concerned about, not with the systems we have today, but maybe with, you know, a system that would come along in a few generations from now, posing a potential kind of existential risk to us all. And this is one of the big fears you hear. And I do look at this a bit in the book. I think it is a risk that is not one we should be overly fearful of today, because the current systems are not anywhere close to posing that kind of risk. And it's not at all clear exactly how we would get to a system that might pose this risk. But that said, I do think there are enough smart people who really are at the forefront of the technology who are concerned about this, that we all should be a little worried too. And it would be good if some smart people spent some time thinking about how we would potentially mitigate these risks. And if we put in place some guardrails now, that would make it harder for somebody to accidentally or, you know, create such a system or to get carried away in trying to build a very capable AI model and then end up with something that would pose a risk.
Well, Jeremy, another problem is AI's ability to hoover up electricity and power. I mean, you didn't really start to read about how much energy is required for these models to grow and expand. Could that be a limiting factor on AI's growth? And it doesn't seem like we're hearing a whole lot about the energy expenditures and needs of these AI models. Could that limit AI's growth?
Absolutely. And actually, that is something that all the people in these tech companies at the forefront of building the most powerful models are worried about, that they will essentially run out of power, particularly that they'll run out of green or renewable power. So right now, it's a little bit of, there is quite a lot of concern about the energy intensity, and but it's a little bit of a nuanced issue. And it sometimes gets, I think, misreported. I mean, sometimes people look at the raw energy numbers and they say, oh my God, this is going to be terrible for the carbon footprint of the world, really. This is going to be terrible for global warming. And the answer is that yes, it might be, but right now, almost all the power that is being used for AI, because it's almost all being done by these very large hyperscale cloud computing companies, and most of them have committed already to using a very large percentage, in some cases 100% green power. And so right now, almost all the energy going into the actual computation is clean energy. It's from renewable sources. But as we continue to build this out, and as we start putting these data centers in more places around the world, and in many cases, you know, governments around the world are really insisting that the companies build data centers locally because they want, especially if the governments themselves want to use this technology, they want to make sure that they kind of have sovereign control over that data and over those data centers. So they're actually insisting that the hyperscalers and these big cloud computing companies start building data centers in places like Indonesia, in places like India, where there is much less renewable power available. And in those cases, there's a real potential that you end up crowding out, or essentially that you end up taking up all the renewable sources available. And then what happens is anybody else who wants to use renewable energy either can't get it or it becomes unaffordable for them, and they end up falling back on these dirtier sources of power. The other thing that's really made headlines lately is that there's been some very shocking reports about how Microsoft and Google have really been thrown off their plans to decarbonize their output to be net zero because of the growth of their data centers. And that is partially related, but not entirely related to AI. But if you look into that again, it turns out it's not about actually running the computations. It turns out that this has a lot to do with how these chips that we use to run computations in data centers, including AI, are made and where they're made. The vast majority of these chips are made in Taiwan by a company called TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation. It makes almost all the AI chips that are used for AI in the world, and it makes a very large percentage of all the chips that are used in data centers in the world. They do not have very great sources of renewable power themselves in Taiwan. So it turns out that the carbon footprint of making these chips is high. Also, there's quite a lot of like rare earth minerals that go into the making of these chips. It turns out the mining of those materials is a very dirty process, very energy intensive and very carbon intensive. And so that is another factor. And when you incorporate those plus the actual construction materials used for the data center, so steel and concrete, those are also both carbon intensive. And it's really I think they're called sort of tier two or carbon emissions that have caused Google and Microsoft such a problem. It's not actually the running of the computations, which tends to kind of get the headlines about how energy intensive the computations are to run. But if you look at what's happened, it's actually about the what's happening with the chips and the physical infrastructure that's caused the carbon footprint of this technology to soar. And I think that we'll hopefully find ways to address this. It's possible AI itself will help in some ways by finding ways to make steel or ways to make concrete that are less carbon intensive. The other thing that would help, of course, is getting more renewable power in Taiwan. And they're also working on that. They're trying to build a very large offshore wind farm in Taiwan right now, which may help TSMC become greener.
Well, let's shift to some of the ways that AI is transforming the way that we go through life. Essentially, I take an Italian lesson, and I was having an issue with a certain concept, and so my teacher said, "Oh, don't worry, I'll do up an exercise for you." And I was thanking her because I imagine how long it took her, And she said, oh, no, I just, you know, mentioned the verbs to ChatGPT and asked to come up with this exercise. And I thought, wow, what a tool for teachers. I mean, anything that can make a teacher's job easier. How is education being transformed?
Yes. I mean, I think this is another area where I'm very bullish on the positive effects that this technology is going to have. And it's interesting because when ChatGPT came out in late 2022, and that was the first sort of AI chatbot that really caught everyone's attention, got everyone sort of to sit up and take notice of AI, teachers were really freaking out and educators were very upset that students were only going to use this technology to cheat. And, you know, teachers wouldn't be able to tell if a student had written papers themselves, and students were going to just use ChatGPT to do their homework for them. And it is true that you can use this technology to cheat. But I think in the long run, if we just change a little bit about how we teach and some of the ways we test and assess students, and I'm not saying that's easy. It does require some work on educators to change what they do a little bit. I think if we do that, the potential here is for this to be an amazing tool. And it really does potentially give every student a personal tutor that can walk them through at their own pace in language that they're going to understand and grasp in a way that sort of meets their learning style, concepts. It can help them with homework in a way that doesn't do it for them, but kind of guides them to the answer. In fact, there's Khan Academy, which is a well-known sort of online tutoring program. They have this. They used one of these AI large language models from OpenAI. It's called GPT-4. It's the same model that underpins ChatGPT. They use that to power something called Khanmigo, which they've now offered to schools, which is designed to be this kind of Socratic tutor. And it won't give away the answer, but it will ask these probing sort of questions that lead the student towards the right solution. And it will then test the student if they really grasp the knowledge of this. And it can give a report to the teacher about that particular student and where they seem to be strong and where they seem to be weak. So the teacher, when the teacher does have a one-on-one human interaction with that student, can really direct their time more effectively and already have this information about how the student's doing. One of the things I say in the book, in the chapter I have on education, is I think it just pushes us more towards sort of instituting these flipped classrooms where a lot of the receiving of knowledge takes place at home potentially, and the practicing of knowledge and the sort of practical problem sets and maybe writing assignments even would take place in class, where a teacher can provide direct kind of intervention and kind of look over the shoulder and see how the student is doing. But also you could potentially use these a chatbot as well. While the teacher's assisting one student, every other student could be using their AI tutor to help them. And the teacher can literally walk around the classroom and, you know, spend a lot of individual time potentially with students that they couldn't do in an older system.
That's really interesting. And I'm wondering, as you see, say, school districts around this country sort of warming up to the idea that, yes, this can be a tool, an effective learning tool. How are they approaching it? Are, you know, is it individual teachers who embrace technology, they're able to use it, or is it, you know, a massive movement?
Yeah, I think there is a sort of movement forming of people who are embracing this. Some schools of education are starting to, you know, really push, advocate that teachers should use this, and they're incorporating into the way they teach teachers. But right now, I'd say there's really a huge diversity, and it varies district to district, state to state, all across the country. Some try to ban the use of the technology by their students. Others say it can be used in certain contexts, that students can use it, but they have to disclose to the teacher how they used it. Some of the schools have used an adopted Khanmigo, this tool from Khan Academy. That does have a cost that they charge per student, but it's they've tried to make it relatively affordable. But I think some districts that find, you know, they're particularly cash strapped and they just feel like they can't afford that kind of technology. So there is this issue right now about equality and equal access to the technology, which I think we're going to have to think hard about how to resolve. But yeah, I'd say it's a real hodgepodge right now about how people are approaching this.
Well, Jeremy, we've had Neeru Khosla on our show before, and she had founded CK12, and they started a program called Flexi, which is an AI chatbot for tutoring, which is amazing because kids from all over the world can access for free this AI chatbot to ask all these questions. Not just CK12, but Khan Academy and any other school district using these, how can they ensure that the information that these students are getting is accurate? Because that's been a problem in the past.
Yeah, and it is a problem if you just naively use any chatbot that you can get, like ChatGPT or Anthropic, which is one from a company called Anthropic's name of the company, sorry, Claude is the name of their chatbot. That is a bit of a problem because these things do are prone to something that AI researchers call hallucination, where they just make up information that it sounds completely plausible. Unless you know the subject really well, you might not know that the information is false. So that is a problem. What the ones that are specifically for students, like Khanmigo or I think CK12 is the same thing, have done is they've taken certain steps that to some extent reduce the chance of hallucination. So one of the things they do is that they do something called retrieval augmented generation, or RAG, which is a technique where instead of just asking the underlying large language model, the underlying AI model, to answer based on everything it's been trained on, you don't do that. You say, we want you to answer only based on the following documents. And you actually give them documents that are approved by the teachers as part of the curriculum. So these would be the same documents, maybe the textbook, for instance, that the student would have to read, or several textbooks that are all sort of legitimate textbooks and have been approved. And you say, answer based on the information found in these sources. And so then it's summarizing something it's retrieved from those sources, as opposed to just trying to draw on as general knowledge. Because what these systems do when you ask them to draw on their general knowledge, if they don't know the answer, is they tend to just make something up. Then, you know, that's the most common case where you get hallucination. Now, doing this retrieval augmented generation reduces the chance of hallucination. It does not completely eliminate it. So there are some other techniques you can use to try to even create another kind of layer of checking. One is to ask for corroboration. Can like it cite a particular source, a particular passage in that information, or maybe from the web, can it cite a particular web page where this information is found? So the teacher or the student can go and actually look and read that source and see if it confirms exactly what the chatbot is saying. So that helps. But of course, that's laborious if you have to check everything it says. And you actually, we do have to be careful, because I think sometimes what will happen is these things are getting pretty good, but not 100%. We still need to teach students, you know, basic research skills to always check the source. Sometimes when these things hallucinate, it actually, although it may be plausible English, it doesn't really make sense. And the teacher, you know, just applying their common sense or what they know about the subject, might easily be able to kind of pick up the hallucination. But these are systems that can help human teachers and augment human teachers. But we're not going to be able to get rid of human teachers because of that issue.
We talk to so many people just in, you know, in our community, or the artists, writers, even, you know, executive assistants, that are really worried about this AI taking away their jobs. And you're right that if used properly, it can actually enhance our jobs. But for those of us who aren't in the tech world, who aren't pushing for more and more AI, what can we do to not be left behind?
Yeah, I think that there's several things. One is, actually, I think it helps if you use the technology yourself. And like, so you understand what it can do and what it can't do. And you also get used to sort of working alongside it. I think if you have those skills where you know how to prompt these systems well and get them to produce decent results, that's a skill, actually, that is a skill that employers will want people to have going forward. So that is actually, you know, and actually, if you're really good at this right now, you could get hired by one of these tech companies at a very high salary to do what's called prompt engineering, which is essentially writing plain English instructions, but in such a way that it can really get the most out of an AI chatbot. But I don't think there's not that many roles for prompt engineers, but I do think lots of us are going to be working alongside an AI co-pilot, which is going to be like a chatbot, but maybe specifically designed for our profession. And I think if we get used to working with these things and getting a sense of how you prompt a chatbot, that will be a skill that will help us as we work alongside these co-pilots. That's one thing. The other would be to just be flexible. I think it helps to have lots of different skills and to be prepared that your job may change. Try to think about what other sort of adjacent things you can do that might use some of the same skills that you currently use. And just be prepared that as, you know, it is possible that as these copilots take on some tasks, that our employers will increasingly ask us to perform other kind of adjacent tasks or higher level tasks. I think that's the other thing. It's sort of these systems right now are pretty good at automating fairly regular routine tasks in jobs. They tend not to be good at doing sort of one-off, very complex tasks, things that would require a very high level of expertise in our field. I think those are areas where, again, the humans still have a real advantage. And to the extent that you can skill yourself up further in your own profession, That's going to help you. I think those, you're going to be in a better position where more tasks, will not be replaced or substituted for by an AI system. So I think those are some things that that I would advise people to do, but also just not to be too frightened. I think, again, at the Brainstorm Tech, Fortune Brainstorm Tech conference that just took place in Salt Lake City there in the area. Eric Brynjolfsson, who is a economist at Stanford, he gave a presentation and he had done one of the foremost studies of looking at what can be automated in jobs. And he said the key is, though, you have to really break it down by task and not by job. And while AI can do lots and lots of tasks, most jobs involve many, many tasks. Most jobs, he said, involve, dozens of tasks. And in most cases, AI can only do, a handful of those. So that means that it's going to change how we work, but most of us are probably still going to have a job.
Well, good to know. And there will be a whole lot of young people going into prompt engineering. That was the first time I've heard of that. So yeah, listen up. Listen up, all you young people. And it's funny, a field like that, prompt engineering, is probably a lot more about sociology or logic, philosophy than it even is about engineering, correct?
Oh yeah, in fact, it's sort of a misnomer. I mean, the people that are being hired for these prompt engineering jobs are very often English graduates because they have good communication skills. Because one of the things that's amazing about this technology is it essentially allows you to program a computer for the first time without knowing a programming language, in what's called natural language, plain English. Just use good English, instruct it as you would instruct a person, but maybe a person who's not, that clever. So very often you have to give very specific instructions to these chatbots, and you have to be very clear about what you want and the format you want it in. But if you can do that, they can produce pretty remarkable results. And I think companies have found that it's very often people who were trained, in the humanities that have these skills, which are very different than the kind of formal coding skills that are taught to computer scientists and engineers.
Yeah, go English majors. Yay. Well, a final question. I mean, I love your book so much that it really details all of these different areas, and we've only gotten into a few of them. But you also examine these bigger existential questions like, will AI somehow rewire our brains? Will it really change us fundamentally, who we are?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. It is one of the areas I am worried about because I think we've already seen with the existing technologies that we have that the way we think has changed and our cognitive abilities have changed. It really is true. I look at in the book studies of the navigational abilities of people who grew up with GPS on their phones the whole time and people who are older who had to learn how to read a map. Turns out the people who are older have much better sort of innate navigational skills than younger people who really don't have those skills. They're so used to navigating on their phone that they really don't even notice landmarks. They have very little, they can't read a map on their own. They really have lost some of the innate ability to navigate that older people had. The same goes for memory. Our memories used to be exercised a lot more. We had to memorize phone numbers, addresses, all sorts of information that are now at our fingertips on our phone and through the internet with Google. It really has changed the way people can remember. And it turns out younger people can remember less than older people. And there's also some studies that show that memory really is important for learning and particularly having a base of knowledge in a field is really important for making further progress in that field. So I worry about that people will become very reliant on the easy answers from these sort of AI chatbots, and we will start to lose some of these critical cognitive skills. And that's one of the reasons I think that when I say we should change the curriculum and the way we teach to accommodate these chatbots, I do think that's true, but I also think we should still be teaching people critical thinking to examine the source of information. I still think we really need to teach people how to write, even though these chatbots are very good at writing. I think one of the real dangers is that they kind of frame the world as if writing and thinking were completely separable activities, and they are not, at least not in my opinion. And I think there's a lot of evidence that writing really hones our ideas, that it is through writing that we understand the logic of what we're saying better and really make better arguments.
Wow. Jeremy Kahn has been our guest in his new book, just out, Mastering AI, A Survival Guide to Our Super-Powered Future. A really comprehensive guide. And we're so pleased that you could join us today on Cool Science Radio. Thank you, Jeremy.
Oh, thank you so much. It was great to be here.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peake.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Well, now that the CrowdStrike update fiasco from now about 2 weeks ago has calmed, we wanted to go back and sort of debrief and do a little forensic look at what happened and what it means for the future. Now, you remember this was the update that caused thousands of issues within Microsoft and then issues with flights in healthcare and probably wreaked havoc on many systems we may not even be aware of. So what are the larger lessons and the observations that perhaps should have been made in retrospect? Joining us now to explore all of this is our local cybersecurity expert and IT expert, Earl Foote. He is the founder and owner of Nexus IT. Earl, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Hey, Lynn, Katie, thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here with you.
Well, it's always great to have you join us because you have a great ability to sort of explain these things within cybersecurity that many of us probably only have had a glimpse at, and we know we should understand it more. So CrowdStrike basically is a cybersecurity company, right? Tell us what they do.
Yeah, very good. You're right, Lynn. CrowdStrike is, they are a major global software publisher of cybersecurity software that is primarily used by enterprise size organizations, large companies, governments. Think of, you know, the global 100, Fortune 500 size of companies, and, you know, governments or other types of institutions. The software helps, you know, and they have various different packages of software. The software helps detect threats. It helps neutralize those threats and then helps engineers, you know, IT and cyber engineers to fight against active hacking attempts to neutralize, mitigate those, and then work on resolving any issues that might happen from those. So it's kind of interesting for this, you know, this event to happen to a major cybersecurity, you know, global cybersecurity organization. I do think that it's worth mentioning that the event that did happen, while in the early stages, there was a lot of confusion about what was happening, what the cause was. It was not a cyber incident. In other words, CrowdStrike, you know, was not hacked. There was not a breach involved. In the end, what happened is that CrowdStrike issued a software update to one of their software packages called Falcon Sensor. That software update caused a major issue with a lot of Microsoft Windows operating systems. And that's what took down computer systems, you know, globally. For specifically, we saw a lot of impact on airlines, but there was significant impact to banking institutions, digital and online banking, you know, major retailers, some governments, you know, some government entities that were impacted. Of course, I think the airlines were the most disruptive and continue to catch up, you know, from this problem. Over the weekend, Lynn, I ran into a couple of pilots just by happenstance, one on the golf course and one at yoga. You know, I asked them about their opinions of the situation and, you know, got a little bit of information from them. It's interesting kind of to note that they both mentioned that it takes airlines, you know, from a major incident like this where there are backup and delays and canceled flights for, you know, days on end. It takes an airline about a week and a half to catch up and get all of the flights back on course, right? If you think about it, just starting from the very first flight that is canceled or delayed, that flight crew is now no longer available to, you know, to catch their next flight that they're scheduled to work. And you just have this massive cascade effect that throws off, you know, subsequent flights across the globe. It's kind of wild that, you know, one small, well, it wasn't small, it was a major global IT outage, right? But this incident could cause, you know, issues that would you know, last a week and a half on end. Kind of one of the major considerations for me here, Lynn, that I think a lot of people don't really necessarily know from behind the scenes, but the financial impacts and the likely financial responsibility here of CrowdStrike is going to end up being astronomical. So CrowdStrike, like any software publisher or cybersecurity organization, will have service level agreements or SLAs with their clients. And those service level agreements generally, and granted, I won't purport to know what are in, you know, CrowdStrike's contracts, although we do, we service, you know, CrowdStrike, we sell and service CrowdStrike for some of our clients. It is primarily a package that is for larger enterprises. So it's not as, it's not super prevalent in the SMB or mid-market spaces. It's more an enterprise, you know, type of product. But that being said, I won't purport to know what is, you know, what the SLAs are in their contracts. However, just knowing what industry standards are, SLAs generally call for billing credits in major outages. And with the, you know, the major outages caused by this situation to airlines and to banks and all sorts of, you know, global institutions, on that matter alone, my guess is that the financial liability for CrowdStrike is going to add up to hundreds of millions of dollars of billing credits that they are going to have to issue to their clients. And then you've got what I would infer that are likely going to be, you know, lawsuits that are going to come out of this situation. Yeah. My guess is that major airlines are going to sue CrowdStrike for, you know, the impact of their operations and the cost of that impact. You have to think the airlines, you know, how many thousands or tens of thousands of billing credits? I mean, it's going to be tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of you know, flight credits and, you know, paying for meals and hotels and all that of people who had delayed flights and you know, all those things that were stranded in remote places and everything like that, right?
Well, so, yeah, you know, it just, it strikes me, and everyone's got a story about what happened, you know, since the CrowdStrike update issue happened. And, you know, personally, my son got married over the weekend, and the best man, it took him 4 days to get here, and he finally, and who was my other son, he finally bought a ticket on Southwest Airlines, and everyone made the joke, Southwest still schedules their pilots via some antiquated spreadsheet, and the question that arises there is that better? I mean, cybersecurity is the most important thing, but when these issues go awry, and to a certain degree, you feel sorry for Delta because they were doing the apologizing. Pete Buttigieg, transportation secretary, was admonishing Delta, but you know, Delta was a down the line kind of receiver of the issue. It's CrowdStrike is the genesis, and then there's Microsoft Windows, and then there's Delta. So exactly. I think the whole thing, this is it. It's like the down the line kind of effects that reverberate throughout the an entire society. And so, you know, from a big picture question, what can be done as we look back at this to fix it?
Yeah, really, really good. And I totally agree with you. And you think about a smaller, you know, regional airline. Well, and really they're not regional, they're national and even international, you know, Southwest at this point. But you know, obviously they weren't using CrowdStrike, which is, you know, in their advantage. Mm-hmm. And as I've mentioned, CrowdStrike is, you know, it's generally a package used by, you know, large enterprises. Southwest probably uses other cybersecurity tools, but CrowdStrike is not within their stack, right? And that's why they were unaffected. And there were multiple airlines like that, you know, of course, the biggest hit were Delta and United. So you ask, you know, Lynn, what can you do in the future, right? Is there a way to prevent this? There's a few answers to that. You know, first and foremost is, look, we are a society completely reliant on technology at this point. That comes with some inherent risks, right? you know, everything we do as a society now runs on technology. And it's interesting because not to infer age, but the three of us are old enough to remember a time when that wasn't the case, right? You know, I remember when I got into this industry, helping companies affect their original digital transformation, taking them off of paper and going to client server environments in the late 90s, right? And I was in my early 20s, but, you know, I mean, 40 or 50 years ago, we were not a society, you know, dependent upon technology. Today we are. In terms of, you know, Delta or banking institutions, there wasn't much they could have done to have prevented this. In fact, there was nothing they could have done to have prevented it. And it's not feasible to have complete redundant backup capabilities across, you know, full networks for institutions this size, right? It's just too cost prohibitive. It's too much to manage. So there isn't anything, you know, specifically they could have done to have prevented it. Now, there probably are some things they could do to have responded better to the situation. And so in our industry, we call those business continuity plans. Mm-hmm. Or incident response plans, specifically when it comes to cybersecurity events. You know, good organizations with really good technology leadership will be very mindful in thinking about technology outages and how do we operate if we have a major problem, whether that's a breach or we just have, you know, a significant outage like this where, you know, systems and servers and all that kind of stuff go down. So, I mean, my recommendation, you know, to whatever size or organization out there is to realize, number one, you have a total dependency upon technology and you have single points of failure. And those single points of failure, you have to think about the risk and mitigate that risk through a business continuity plan. And if it's not something that you have an inherent capability for, then look to a provider like Nexus IT or somebody who can step in and do some consulting with you and figure out, you know, what are your operational backup plans? Because you may have to go to paper, which the airlines did, right? But it took them a long time to do that.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Earl Foote. He's the owner of Nexus IT. We are talking about the CrowdStrike outage and what its implications are. Well, so much of the coverage was related around airlines, of course, because there were thousands and thousands of people stranded globally. But this also happened with banks and hospitals. So if I would have made a deposit maybe right before this happened, did my money make it into the bank?
That's a good question, Katie, and I don't know the answer to that yet, but I would definitely recommend, you know, for anybody who's done any significant financial transactions over the last week and a half or 2 weeks to you know, go check your accounts, make sure that those transactions executed the way that you expected. Check in with your bank if you feel like you need to, because yes, there were major you know, digital banking services, ATM operations across the globe that were affected by this. And it's entirely possible that, yeah, you had, you know, a deposit and hopefully you've saved receipts, you know, because you may have to prove that you made a deposit if, you know, if that was lost in transit or something like that.
So this company, CrowdStrike, I mean, you use them, you sell them. They are obviously a big global, probably up until last week, a well-respected company. How did this happen? What step did they miss to cause this massive outage?
Yeah, very good. And you're right, Katie. You know, in terms of enterprise grade cybersecurity solutions, CrowdStrike has been the gold standard. They have been the top number one provider globally. What did they miss? And this is somewhat due to speculation, but I think there's pretty substantiated information out there now, Katie. So CrowdStrike was attempting to resolve a vulnerability in their own software. So there was what we call in our industry zero-day exploits that was identified in CrowdStrike software. In other words, there was a bug in the software that would allow hackers to infiltrate the software. And in response to that that bug, CrowdStrike scurried to execute and issue an update to patch the vulnerability. What appears to have happened is that they didn't adequately sandbox, they didn't adequately test that update across enough platforms to say it's safe to issue this. They favored on the side of speed of releasing the patch instead of risk mitigation and being careful about testing the patch before they sent it out. They do claim that they did do sandboxing, but it appears that it wasn't adequate. And there were some, there were obviously hundreds of thousands of computers globally that had a conflict with the update, and it caused the Windows operating system to break. On the CrowdStrike side, Katie, they probably have got to figure out how to slow down a little bit, even in the face of you know, security risk, slow down a little bit, adequately test their software patches, you know, before they issue them. And the other thing, Katie, here is that this is a major ding to the reputation of CrowdStrike at this point, right? You're going to see a lot of institutions that are that no longer trust the product or the brand. You're going to see some that are going to opt to move to different products. That's a major undertaking and a major cost. So, you know, some are going to evaluate it and decide whether it makes sense or not. But certainly, I would expect over the next year, year and a half, for sales to significantly taper off for CrowdStrike. I would guess that they're going to have massive financial implications, not only the SLA credits, you know, lawsuits, but also just the revenue is going to probably be significantly impacted for several quarters on end here.
Yeah, that is so interesting. And it makes me wonder if, you know, you talk about that CrowdStrike acted in a way that was rushed and maybe didn't do kind of a strategic rollout or a test of the patch because they wanted to mitigate that vulnerability quickly. Was there anything that made CrowdStrike believe that, or is there any indication that there are hacks that are being attempted? You know, we get those little notifications on our computer if we have some sort of protection, and I never know if they're real or not. Like, oh, we've stopped 34 attempts at hacking. You know how you get those pop-ups. And so I'm just wondering, would a large software company like CrowdStrike have some indication that there were active malicious hacking attempts going on?
In general, Lynn, yes. The answer is yes. In this situation, you know, supposedly based upon the information that has been received so far, or released so far, CrowdStrike did not have an active breach, right? Now, a large organization like CrowdStrike is going to be a massive target all the time for hackers. You know, in fact, a small radio station like KPCW is as well. You know, I mean, we're all you know, targets for hackers at this point. But obviously a massive organization that has a footprint globally in infrastructure all over the place, right, is going to be a significant target. And so, you know, these types of organizations, they have very robust practices and teams who are testing their penetration testing and vulnerability assessing, you know, their own software, their own infrastructure all the time, looking for bugs like this. They also have bug bounty programs. So they have, you know, if a benevolent white hat hacker happens to discover a vulnerability in their software and reports it to them, they offer a bounty, or in other words, they'll pay money for you identifying a problem in their software that could be exploited by hackers. That's super common in the software industry. Oftentimes a vulnerability like the one that CrowdStrike was trying to patch will be exposed either by their internal teams that are assessing, or by, you know, external people or entities that are hunting for potential vulnerabilities. Hopefully, you know, they're discovered by benevolent, you know, white hat hackers before they're discovered by black hat hackers. But what often happens is a software publisher like CrowdStrike will find a zero-day exploit. They actually publish that to the public to notify the public to patch, you know, to take whatever steps are necessary to mitigate that risk. And in that time frame that it takes organizations to execute upon patching the vulnerability, you're going to have a significant uptick of hacking attempts trying to exploit the vulnerability. So those are, you know, and generally those will last for 24 to maybe 72 hours or so, a 0-day exploit while everybody's getting patches, you know, deployed. Yes, hackers will go, they'll go to town trying to find systems that they can hack in that time period. Yeah.
Yeah. Earl, as you're talking, and this is perhaps more of a sociological, you know, question, and I'm going to be very Pollyanna in asking it, is I have never understood how there can be that much maliciousness. What is the motivation in these large systems for, you know, you talk about the white hat hackers. So yep. They're the ones that try to sell the fix and try to expose the vulnerability. But at the end of the day, what is the motivation? If you are a brilliant technological mind, why do you go bad instead of good? Isn't it always better and easier to be good?
I mean, I think that the same question is applicable across, you know, all sorts of criminal considerations of society, right? You can always choose to apply your intellect, your talents, and your gifts, you know, in a constructive manner that is supportive to society, or you can choose to be a criminal, right? When it comes to digital wizards, you know, it's the same consideration. And in the end, what is the motivation? For the most part, you know, Lynn, it comes down to monetary consideration, right? There are massive paydays in being a threat actor and being a hacker. For some, it is a, you know, they have a social beef with, you know, large institutions or governments, and they do this from their perspective for moral consideration, you know, but for the majority, it comes down to looking for financial gain. And some of these hackers or hacking institutions are making tens and hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And I say hacking institutions because you have major networks that are, you know, that collaborate. And with digital, you know, in a digital age, you've got networks that band together globally of hundreds or thousands of hackers that will execute hacking, you know, incidents on major institutions, you know, for the payday that you know, they can generate from it.
Let's talk about personal level, because this was a institution-wide big company like airlines, hospitals, banks. But what do we need to worry about as, you know, of course, I'm on a Mac, and there's all those, we'll talk about Mac security in a second, but how does the regular consumer protect themselves? And not in terms of a hacking software, but to make sure that the software that we get is actually up to date.
Yeah, really good, Katie. And certainly the consideration for a standard consumer versus a large business are very different. However, really the considerations and the recommendations boil down to the same. You know, first off, Katie, you ask about the quality of the software really, and, you know, patching that software. So for consumers, you know, be mindful about the type of software that you're purchasing or loading on your computers or your mobile devices. Make sure that it, you know, it is a globally, well, you know, at least a large brand that has reputation behind it, that has some tenure. It's not something brand new. And then certainly be running updates. So whether you're on a Mac or you're on Windows, you know, run regular updates, or whether you're on your mobile device, run regular updates for those devices to update your software packages. Beyond that, Katie, having good what's called endpoint security, or what we used to call antivirus software, you know, look for and have good endpoint security. And generally, you want next gen endpoint security software that has some AI enablement that will seek out malicious behavior and neutralize it. You know, that's always a good idea. Good password management, multi-factor authentication. You know, these are all things that whether you're a large business or you're a consumer in today's world, you should be doing. And always back up. Always back up your data. Always back up your critical data and have good backups available, you know, in case you need to wipe away a computer and start over because you've had a major incident.
Wow. Well, Earl Foote, owner and founder of Nexus IT, I have a feeling we could talk to you all day about all of these things. But as always, we'll have you back on. Thank you so much for making these concepts clear to us and to our listeners.
Yeah, my pleasure. Been fun. Thank you, ladies, for the invite.
You have been listening to KPCW Park City. You can always find our archive shows at kpcw.org under the Shows tab in Cool Science Radio or wherever you get your podcasts. NPR One, for example, KPCW, Cool Science Radio.